Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you to Lucien for the invitation, and thank you to everybody for coming. Today I'm going to talk about new work whose title is The Principle of Relative Locality, and it's a bit nervous-making because I woke up this morning realizing that the first maxim is that you don't give a colloquium about recent work, but nonetheless, here we go. This is work with Laurent Freidel here, Giovanni Emilino Camelia in Rome, and Ira Kowalski-Glickman in Warsaw. And the origin of this work were discussions with Giovanni and Jurek visiting, so thanks very much to the collaborator program. Now, the work presented is in one paper already out and several papers in presentation in preparation. Now, many thanks also to Sabina Hassenfelder, who stimulated this work by uncovering an apparent paradox in earlier work on deformed special relativity or doubly special relativity. In a sense, this is the answer to that paradox, and related paradoxes were raised, related issues were raised by Robert Schoesfeld and Bill Unruh. The subject is non-locality. Their worry is that there were a class of theories which have flagrant non-localities in them, and what I'm going to be showing you is that there is a class of theories in which the principle of locality is relaxed but in a controlled manner, which is experimentally accessible and doesn't cause any problem with existing knowledge or with paradoxes. Thanks also to Michele Arzano, Florian Girelli, Atera Levine, Seth Major, and many other people here for discussions on this subject. Right. Now, this is work about the nature of space and time, and we really want to change your mind here. We feel that we have gone through a door. Laurent likes to say relative locality is a door that you step through, and it's hard to step back. It may or may not be true about nature, but it gives a compelling picture of a new way in which quantum gravity effects may show up in the description of nature. And it's very easy to talk about this at the level of the most basic phenomenon of space and time and observation. So we start with a question. Just look around in this room, and do you see space? Do we see space? Is what we see objects in space? Now, Diego Rivera, the great Mexican muralist, married husband of Frida Kahlo, has a famous aphorism where he says, "I don't see space, I see things," and this is the beginning of our discussion. Now, of course, as relativists, as people trained in special and general relativity theory, we're used to the idea that we don't see space, we see space-time, because when I look at a person in the last row there, it takes some time for light to travel to me, and because the light is a maximum velocity, looking outward is looking backward in time. So we don't see objects in space. We see objects in space-time. At least that's what we've been taught to believe as relativists. But in fact, if we think about it, we don't see space-time either. What we really most fundamentally observe is momentum space. That is, as individuals, what we observe are photons of light coming at us from different angles in different colors. So we're something like calorimeters with clocks, because we have an internal clock. And also, as particle physicists at the LHC, or even more as astronomers looking out with our different wavelengths of telescopes, we are looking out into momentum space, photons and other quanta of different frequencies and momenta impinging on us at different times from different directions. So we want to take the point of view here that momentum space is fundamental. Space-time is inferred. And in fact, Einstein taught us this in his first paper on special relativity in 1905, that if we describe events distant from the observer, we do that by the exchange of light signals. So here is the world line of an observer. We send out a light signal at the origin of our coordinates, and we define the coordinates of distant events from the proper time S that it takes a light signal to go to that event and come to us. If that proper time is S, we're able to give coordinates to this distant event at time s over t, spatial position s, sorry, s over 2, spatial position s over 2. So what Einstein was doing was teaching us how to infer the geometry of space-time by measurements which are fundamentally measurements of momentum space and proper time. Now, we're used to thinking nonetheless as theoretical physicists, as field theorists, which many of us are, of course, in this room, that space-time is fundamental, fields live on space-time, momentum space is secondary and auxiliary. We're used to thinking of that as relativists as well. The momentum space is the cotangent space of a manifold. But let's think, as quantum physicists, there's the Born principle of reciprocity that we can either way describe experiments in a position space basis or a momentum space basis. And one of the ways into the point of view that we want to introduce you to is to try to maintain the Bohr reciprocity into the classical limit where h bar goes to zero. And indeed, Max Born was the first person to investigate this, the kind of geometry of momentum space I'm going to be talking about in a minute, all the way back in 1938 or so. Okay. Now, if we infer space-time geometry from of distant events, from measurements made by an observer, there are two questions to be asked. Do we all infer the same space-time geometry? That is, if we here and distant observers, say a few megaparsecs away, reconstruct the same picture of events going on in space-time distant to us both, do we all construct the same space-time description? A related question, as you'll see, is do we reconstruct the same space-time description if we measure at different energies, if we use photons of different wavelengths, red or blue? Okay. Now, in special relativity, the answer is yes, and there's a fundamental reason why all the observers in space-time reconstruct the same space-time picture, no matter where they are and no matter what frequencies they use for their probes in momentum space, and that's that translations in physics are generated by the law of conservation of energy and momentum, and the conserved total energy and momentum, P total, is what generates translations in space and time through Poisson brackets. Now, if the law of conservation of energy and momentum is linear, so the total momentum of a system with many particles is the sum of their individual momentums, the total energy is the sum of their individual energies, then the translations which are generated by Poisson bracket with the total momentum and energy are constant because the x that should be, sorry, x there rather than delta x, the x Poisson brackets with p to give just a constant. So if you have a description of some events taking place in space-time with one observer, say some world lines colliding, scattering, and you translate that description to the description of another observer, that translation just takes all the world lines and moves them by a fixed amount. This may seem a trivial point, but we'll see in a moment it's a far from trivial point. Okay. So if an interaction is local in particular for one observer, it remains local for distant observers. If it's local in a description using light at one wavelength, it's local for a description at other wavelengths. But what if the conservation laws are nonlinear? And I'm going to be giving a justification in a little while for considering the conservation laws to be nonlinear. But just follow me here, and let's just assume that the conservation laws being linear, that is the total conserved energy being the sum of all the energies of the individual system, is only an approximation to a deeper nonlinear law, and let's follow the consequences. Do we still infer all the same space-time, and do we still infer the same space-time at different energies? Well, let's see. Now, we translate still the principle that translations are generated by total momentum and energy remains the same, but if there are nonlinear terms, and all that, don't ignore that, that's just a way to notate that the total momentum and energy is the sum of the momentum of energy plus some nonlinear terms. Okay. Then when we take the Poisson bracket to generate the translations in space-time position of some worldlines, the translation has some terms which depend on the energy carried by the worldlines. So how much the space-time coordinates of a worldline are translated now depends on how much momentum and energy that worldline carries. That means the description of events are different at different energies. In particular, if you have a point which is an interaction, a local interaction between two particles of different energies, when translated to the point of view of distant observers, it may no longer look local. And that's the key insight that underlies the proposal that we're making here. We call that the principle of relative locality. And just to be clear, we are not claiming that it's not objective whether or not an interaction is local. There will always be local interactions which will look local in space and time relative to observers that are nearby them. But we'll see that there are effects which distort the description of distant events such that an event which is local and looks properly local from the point of view of an observer next to it will look non-local from the point of view of a distant observer. And that we call the principle of relative locality. Now, there turns out to be a simple and beautiful mathematical framework for this based on the geometry of momentum space that is based on coding nonlinearities in the conservation laws in a geometrical picture, and that's what I'll be presenting. Now, what regime of physics is this relevant for? Before I talk to you about the geometry, let me talk about quantum gravity and where to find quantum gravity effects. Imagine there is some quantum theory of gravity. It doesn't matter for our purposes what it is. What matters is that it has parameters, Planck's constant, Newton's constant, the speed of light. Maybe there's a cosmological constant, although I'll be ignoring that in everything today. That can be easily put back in. And we're used to thinking that while we don't know the quantum theory of gravity or we have different competing proposals for it, we know the G Newton go to zero limit of the quantum theory of gravity. It's quantum field theory on Minkowski space. Or we know the H-bar goes to zero limit. That's general relativity coupled to some fields, classical fields. But here's another limit you can consider. Here's a limit where we take those two constants, the Newton's constant and the Planck's constant, to zero, but in such a way that their ratio, the square root of which is a mass, is held fixed. That is, we're interested in a domain of phenomena where this mass, which is the Planck mass, 10 to the 19 JeV, is relevant for some experiment, but H-bar is not relevant and G-Newton is not relevant. So consider that regime of a quantum gravity effects, of an approximation to a quantum theory of gravity where those limits are relevant. Okay. That is some relativistic world which has an invariant velocity and some invariant mass scale. And we're going to posit that that mass scale characterizes nonlinearities in momentum space and try to code what phenomena might be observable as kind of the Cheshire cat of quantum gravity in this regime. Now, what question can we probe if we can get into this regime? Basically, we're probing the question of what's the symmetry of the ground state of quantum gravity. It's a regime which is very suitable to be probing that question. Now, general relativity has no symmetries, but its ground state has a symmetry which is Poincaré invariance. Presumably the quantum theory of gravity, with the geometry of space-time being background independent and dynamical, has no symmetries, but its ground state should have symmetries. Are those symmetries Poincaré invariant, as in classical general relativity, or, as some theorists have proposed, is there a preferred reference frame for quantum gravity effects so that Poincaré invariance is broken? And there are good people who have proposed that. For example, if there's some underlying, if space-time and gravity are emergent from some underlying discrete theory, like a lattice theory, that might be expected. Or there's a bunch of proposals where Poincaré invariance is deformed or modified in quantum gravity. An example of this is 2 plus 1 quantum gravity, as shown definitively in the work of Laurent and Achera Levine, but many other people have contributed to that, where the Poincaré invariance becomes deformed or modified, but there's still a relativity of inertial frames. So in this regime, we want to think about experiments that probe the symmetry of the ground state of quantum gravity and reveal which of these options is realized in nature. Now, while we're doing that, let's think about what scales we expect to see quantum gravity effects. We're used to thinking that quantum gravity effects will be seen at the Planck scale, and we're used to thinking that's very, very small, that's very hard to see, and so forth. But in this regime, the Planck length is zero, so quantum gravity effects at the Planck length are not relevant for this regime. Instead, just by dimensional analysis, there's a realm of quantum gravity effects which occur at very large scales. This is a kind of surprise. These are infrared quantum gravity effects which will appear in this regime, left over kind of the Cheshire cat smile again of quantum gravity. And just by dimensional reasons, we expect these quantum gravity effects to go proportional to the energy over a mass scale. Remember, we have a preferred mass scale but no length scale. So they have to scale like some dimensionless ratio of these, and we'll see that there are phenomena to the first power and the second power and so forth. And then this length scale of quantum gravity effects dimensionally, since there's no h-bar, can only be proportional to x. So these are effects that are going to grow at very distant in situations where we're describing phenomena very distant from the observer. Now, you might think that that broke translation invariance, or you might think that that somehow, how could the size of a quantum gravity effect depend on the coordinate or the distance from an observer? And we'll see in the framework that we're going to develop that there is a precise and well-defined way in which one can have such effects without breaking translation invariance of the fundamental theory. Okay, now, there are real experiments that probe this domain of phenomenon, some of them which are going on now. And by probe, I mean probe with phenomena which are perceptible at order of energies over Planck energies, which test the symmetry of the ground state. I'll be talking later about gamma ray burst time of flight experiments as measured at Fermi, which have that kind of sensitivity now, so I'll come back to that. But just to mention, there are others by Fringens, tests of the speed of light being polarization dependent is measured way past the Planck scale in polarized radio galaxy. Tests of whether there's a preferred frame or Lorentz invariance is measured in the GZK cutoff by Auger, particularly recently. And all these experiments and others can be modified by positing nonlinearities in momentum space. Now, very naively, because this is going to turn out, as we'll see, to not be the best way to describe the phenomenon, but very naively, just to get a sense of the dimensions involved, we could think that modifying the quantum gravity effects of order 1 over a mass scale, proportional to energy over a mass scale, could affect the speeds of propagation. So the speed of a photon could depend on the energy in this kind of fashion. And as I said, such an effect by which the speed of a photon varies with energy could be parity even or parity odd. If it's parity odd, and the motivation for that is that that's the leading term in effective field theory, then it leads to birefringence or rotations of planes of polarization, and that's ruled out way past the Planck scale. If it's parity even, it can be seen in time of flight measurements. And to get a sense of the scale, if we have two photons with an energy difference delta E, which travel for a time t, then we're talking about a difference in arrival times given by the difference in energies over the quantum gravity mass times the time of flight. And for the quantum gravity, for the Planck scale, for 10 billion light years, for 10 GeV, that's about a second. And that effect is already bounded at about the Planck scale by some events that have been seen with very energetic photons by the Fermi gamma ray observatory. One in particular, this particular gamma ray burst, GRB-090510, had a 13 GeV photon coming 0.8 seconds after the burst, and that gave a bound of that quantum gravity scale being greater than 1.2 times the Planck mass. And this little chart tells how over the years, from 1999 to that measurement, the bound on that kind of timing effect or deviation of the speed of light with energy has developed upward from 10 to the 15 GeV to 10 to the 19 GeV, where it is now. Okay, and that made a big noise. There was a paper in Nature, etc. And the rest of the talk, what I want to tell you about, is an attempt to address that experiment by asking, what if there are nonlinearities in the laws of energy and momentum conservation, which can be described by saying that momentum space fundamentally is a curved space. That is, we're in a regime where there's this mass scale which is relevant. What could it describe? How could a mass scale deform physics if fundamentally physics is momentum space? It could deform physics by curving the momentum space. And what we want to do is measure that curvature using the experiment just described in other experiments. Okay. Now, just to tell you where we're going, I'm now going to tell you there are three more parts of the talk. I'm now going to give you a very quick introduction to the geometry of momentum space, as is relevant for measurements in physics. I'm then going to talk to you about how to code that geometry in a description of dynamics of point particles interacting with each other, which is relevant for this experimental regime we're interested in. And I'm then going to come back and discuss an interpretation of those experiments, the gamma ray burst experiments. Okay. Now, from your studies of general relativity, and I assume everybody here has had a little bit, there are two features of geometry of a curved space that we learn about. There is the metric of the geometry, and there is the parallel transport measured also by the connection and the curvature. There's a beautiful picture, and this I have to say, this beautiful mathematical picture was developed by Laurent, in which these separate phenomenologically. When we make measurements on a single particle, we measure the mass, the invariant quantities, particularly the relationship between energy and momentum, the energy-momentum relation, and this, as I'll show you, codes the metric of momentum space. So those are measurements we make with single particles. And then multi-particle measurements, what happens when particles scatter, probe the connection or the curvature of momentum space. So there's a clean separation between those two fundamental quantities, and I'll explain to you how that happens. Okay. So when you measure one particle, what you're particularly trying to do is see if it's still true that E squared is equal to P squared plus M squared. And that's a quadratic relation. And that more generally codes a notion of a metric geometry on momentum space. So rather than E squared minus P squared, there's some general notion, the distance. So if you're in momentum space, there's an origin. I forgot to draw this. There's a point of momentum space which codes the energy and momentum that you measure with your calorimeter. And if there's a distance function on the space, you can say what's the distance between the origin and those values of energy and momentum. And that's what in special relativity would be E squared minus P squared. And that is set equal to the mass squared. And that's the kind of measurement by which we measure the metric geometry of momentum space. little word for experts, in general relativity, we're used to doing everything which is diffeomorphism invariant or invariant under choices of coordinates on space-time, and we can also do that in the description of momentum space, although I'm not going to be doing that or emphasizing that in this talk. Okay. Now, what about when we have an interaction where we combine momentum? So let's imagine I have an electron which has a momentum of k, which in momentum space, here's the origin of momentum space, and here's the point corresponding to momentum k. And let's suppose that a photon of momentum p is absorbed by that electron, and there's some rule which decides what is the total momentum and energy of the electron after it absorbs the photon. So in other words, there's a rule that takes the momentum of the electron and the photon, and sorry, that should be q and not p, and gives me a new momentum for the final state of the electron. And let's just assume that that's some combination rule, some algebraic rule that I'm going to call k big O plus q. So there's just some rule that lets me combine two momentum to get a third momentum. I'm not going to assume it's linear, and I'm not going to assume it's commutative, and I'm not even going to assume it's associative. There's just some rule that tells me how to combine momentum. And I'm going to try to understand how experiment can discover what this rule is. Okay. Now, mathematically, what turns out is that what you're doing is we know how to add a vector to another vector in a linear space, but to add a point which is sitting at the end of a geodesic to another point at the end of another geodesic to get a third point requires a notion of parallel transporting. Parallel transporting this momentum and its tangent vector here alongside the other curve to get the third momentum here. So in the mathematical work that Laurent did, he proved that given such a rule, there is a definition of a parallel transport or a connection on the space. If you, for example, make p infinitesimal, so you're adding a little dp to k, that gives you a parallel transport operator u, whose leading term is 1 plus connection coefficients, just like the connection coefficients in relativity. So if we could experimentally measure very precisely how energy and momentum combine in interactions, we would be measuring the connection geometry of momentum space. Now, more complicated processes involving three or more particles are built up by combinations of these. We assume neither that this rule is commutative nor associative nor linear. We do assume there's an inverse, that is, there's a rule that turns an incoming momentum into an outgoing momentum. And people who are used to playing with Feynman diagrams do that all the time, and we assume there is such a rule. And that's all. We're going to develop the mathematics in generality and then let experiment decide what the actual geometry of momentum space is. That's the general case. Now, these nonlinear composition rules, how we connect them to experiment is that in some experiment in which there's some interaction, there's some incoming momenta, some outgoing momenta, and there's some combination of them that combine to zero. And you have to, the physics is going to tell you what that is, the physical theory is going to tell you how to form that quantity, which is the conservation rule. In ordinary special relativistic physics, it's just the sum of the momenta, taking them all incoming. Now it will be some nonlinear rule. Okay? Is everybody with me on what the context is? Yes? It's input. We want to measure where the brackets are. He's asking about these, why these brackets are here rather than here, which is checking associativity. Now, here's some of the things that are coded. If we combine two momenta and then take derivatives and then evaluate them at the origin, for small momenta, that measures some connection coefficients. if we study the asymmetry in that, that is P combined with Q, if the electron had momentum Q and the photon had momentum P, if we reverse them, meaning, of course, that the photon has to be virtual, or one of them at least has to be virtual, but why not, then that measures the torsion of the connection. The torsion is the anti-symmetric part of the connection. Associativity is measured by the curvature. That is, if it matters on what order you combine the momentum in the interaction, then the momentum space has curvature. That's a very elegant relation. I'm not going to take you through it, but the associativity is measured by the curvature of momentum space. Okay. Thus, there are three things that we can measure, three tensors that are interesting to measure. The torsion, which is the non-commutativity, the curvature, which measures the non-associativity, and I've also been discussing the geometry of the parallel transport rule, and the metric has not come in. The metric on momentum space, remember, is measured by the energy-momentum relation of single particles. So you can ask, is, as in general relativity, the covariant derivative of the metric zero? Well, there's no reason it ought to be, a priori. They're measured by different aspects of physics. So there's a third tensor called the non-metricity, which measures the extent to which these two notions of geometry are different, are independent of each other. Okay, so keep in mind the torsion, the curvature, and the non-metricity, the independence of the two kinds of geometry. Okay, that's the end of the math lesson. On to dynamics. Okay? Yes? If the particles are different types, you know. If the particles are the same type, then you would expect that Fermi and Bose statistics would give you symmetrization and anti-symmetrization automatically. So you would not expect to see, to measure torsion in identical particles with Bose statistics. We can come back to that. Okay, you need particles of different type to give meaning to this. In 3+1 dimensions. Yes? No, there are two, given a metric, there's a notion of a connection compatible with it, but there's another notion of a connection which is measured independently, and they could be different. Okay. Now, dynamics. Okay. Now, because we're working when h bar equals zero and g newton equals zero, it's sufficient for our purposes to study dynamics as particle dynamics. That is, particles following world lines which interact at points where energy and momentum are conserved. So the way we approach that is we specify a process, some particle came in, emitted another particle, say a photon, which then scattered off a third particle, and then you have, so the initial state is two incoming particles, the final state is two outgoing particles, etc. Specify the process as if this was a Feynman diagram. Okay. Then there'll be an action principle to be extremized for the process, which has free parts, which give the laws that the world lines satisfy when they're not interacting, and interacting terms in the action, one for each interaction. And this is standard in special relativity. I'm going to show you, remind you, how it's done in special relativity, and then we're going to modify to curve the geometry of momentum space. Okay. So let's first look at the world line. The formalism that turns out to be useful is a formalism that gives an action for each world line, what's called, which can be thought of as a free relativistic particle, where the action is already written in the phase space. So there's a coordinate, xa, are the space-time coordinates, and their canonical momenta, k. Okay. And the form of the action is xk dot, and then there's a Lagrange multiplier n, and then the Lagrange multiplier enforces the energy-momentum relation as a constraint. This is a fancy way of writing the dynamics of a free particle in special relativity, and it's suitable for our purposes. Okay, and some of you will be familiar with this, and some of you not. You vary everything in the action. You find, first of all, that x and k are canonically conjugate. This is x, k dot. You may be used to thinking it's k, x dot, but live with us. It's actually k, x, k dot. N is a Lagrange multiplier. You vary it, you get the energy-momentum relation. You vary x, you find k is constant, k dot is zero. You vary k, and you get x dot is related to the derivative of c. N gives you the rate that time is flowing. And you get, in the particular case of an energy-momentum relation, x dot proportional to p. Okay. So that is a standard thing in textbooks. And let me point out a feature of it that's not often emphasized, which is that this is supposed to be about motion in Minkowski spacetime, but it makes no reference to the geometry of Minkowski spacetime. Here, in the energy-momentum relation, is the metric of momentum space. Minus e squared plus k squared is an invariant, plus k spatial squared is an invariant. So this measures the geometry of momentum space. There's no metric here because momenta are covectors to positions which are vectors, so there's no metric in contracting them. Okay? So the space-time geometry is inferred from the solutions of the dynamics of the equations of motion. It's not put in. Therefore, there's an opportunity for us to ask the following question. Supposing I curve momentum space so that I replace the Minkowski geometry by a curved geometry, what happens to the motion in position space? I need make no assumptions about what happens to the geometry in space-time. We're going to infer the geometry of space-time. This is consistent with the motivation I gave at the beginning that momentum space is fundamental. Okay, so let's do that. And all we do to modify the free particle dynamics is use the distance function on the curved momentum space here rather than the Minkowski metric. Everything else is exactly the same. So the free particle, again, as we said, just measures the distance function or the metric on the momentum space. Now, what about the interaction? The interacting Lagrangian is very simple. Its job is to enforce the conservation law, say in a trivalent interaction, that there's some function of the incoming momenta, the three incoming momenta, which is zero, which is constructed by some choice of the geometry of momentum space and where you put the order in the brackets. Okay. So we want to enforce this conservation law. So we take a Lagrange multiplier Z, and we just make the interaction Lagrangian the Lagrange multiplier times the conservation law. That's what we would do in special relativity, and that's all we do here. The conservation law has coded into it the connection geometry of momentum space, whether there's torsion, non-metricity, curvature, et cetera, is coded into here. And that's all we do. Now, Z or Z is a Lagrange multiplier, but it becomes a kind of position, space-time, and in a sense, which I'm about to make precise, it's the location of the interaction. Although now we're about to learn what I meant by saying that locality is relative by unfolding this dynamic. So the dynamics, just to review, has a free part and an interacting part. And in the equations of motion, there are additional equations of motion that come from two places. They come from varying the Zs, which enforce the conservation laws, but there's also another set of equations of motion that come from varying from the momenta at the endpoints, because at the endpoint of each world line that comes into the vertex, there is a momentum that is both on the world line and in the vertex. And there's a special equation of motion that comes from varying those momenta at the endpoints. which I'll come to in a minute. Now, there are, what's going on here? And what's the notion of space-time that comes from the dynamics? This is the key point where the geometry and the physics work together. There are two kinds of space-time coordinates. Now, generally, the phase space, for those who know the mathematics, if you don't worry about this, is the cotangent bundle over the momentum space. That's a fancy thing that the mathematicians will understand. Let me decode what that means. Okay. Let's think about the axes that the world lines live on. The axes, where do they live? Well, they're conjugate to a k's, and the k is the momentum on a particular world line. So they live in a space of position and time coordinates, which lives, in a sense, over each momentum. That is, over each point in momentum space, there is what the mathematicians call the cotangent space. There's a space where the positions and the times of particles moving with that momentum live. And if the momentum space is curved, then those spaces are different for different momenta. So there is no single space-time. There is a version of space-time above each momentum, which is where the world line lives of a particle that has that momentum. Okay. So these kind of coordinates, which are the ones which are canonically conjugate to the momenta, are themselves momentum-dependent. Pretty wild, but wait. Okay. Where do the z's live? The z's multiply a function of the momenta, which is zero by the conservation law. So they live in a space of coordinates which is over the origin of momentum space. The z's live down here. Now, the z's, therefore, in a certain sense, are not momentum dependent because they're associated, because of the conservation laws, with the space built over the origin of momentum space. Now, you might say, great, that's space-time. The other coordinates are momentum-dependent. They're weird. But maybe the space-time is coordinatized by the z's. That's, after all, related to where the interactions happen. But there's an unusual feature, which is in this phase space of all the z, of all the coordinates and all the momentum, you can work out their Poisson brackets, and they don't commute with each other. It's just a computation you can do. So these z's are universal. That is, they live at zero momentum, but they're non-commutative. Now, what's the relationship between the z's and the x's? Okay, and the relationship is gotten by those equations of motion that come from varying the momentum at the endpoint. And that relationship says there's a matrix that connects the x at each endpoint of each world line with the z associated with that interaction. And that matrix is gotten by taking the derivative of the conservation law by the momentum at the endpoint. Now, if the conservation laws are linear, these matrices are one, and then the z's and the x's are the same thing. Then the interactions are local. So in the case of special relativity, the conservation laws are linear, and the x's in each interaction live at the same point, and they live at these z's, and everything is as you're used to thinking. But when the conservation laws are nonlinear, these matrices have content, they're not equal to the identity, and the x's and the z's are different. Now, for the geometers in the audience, what's going on is that there's a parallel transport that takes you, that knows about the curvature of momentum space, and takes you from the version of space-time above the origin of momentum space, which is the non-commutative version, to the momentum-dependent version of space-time over this, where the world lines propagate. And these parallel propagators tell you that there's a kind of curvature in the phase space which is inherited from the curvature of momentum space. And all the details, which I'm going to suppress from now on, have to do with how this parallel transport, which carries the curvature into the phase space, codes both the geometry of momentum space and the conservation laws of the physics. Okay, this is the most sophisticated transparency of the talk. Okay. Now we look at its consequences, and just look at the pictures. Okay, on the first pass, unless you're a geometer and you want to connect the pictures to the geometry picture I just showed you. And then we're going to talk about a real experiment. Okay. Now, if you're a local observer, let's go back to this formula. If you're a local observer, then the Z where the interaction takes place is at the origin of your coordinate frame. So if you're a local observer in space-time, then Z is 0. Then also each of the x's in your interaction are 0, and the interaction takes place at the origin, and everybody is local. So there are always, for each interaction, in other words, if I project this picture down into space-time, into one of the versions of space-time, then if you're using space-time coordinates at the origin, or you choose them to be at the origin where the interaction took place, then you see a local interaction. If you translate this picture by using the total momentum involved in the conservation law, then these different world lines and their endpoints translate in a way that's momentum dependent, and your picture, if you're a distant observer, your picture of the same scattering process looks non-local, where the Zs and the Xs are related by those matrices, which depend on the momenta carried by the world line. Okay. So this is the relativity of locality. For every interaction that conserves momentum and energy, there are observers whose description in terms of space-time coordinates would see it as a local interaction, and therefore we believe in locality. But if you're a distant observer, say 10 billion light years away, then your reconstruction or your projection into space-time will see it as taking place non-locally. This is the relativity of locality. Okay, and for the geometers in the audience, this gap here is the result of this parallel transport. Okay. Now, what's the scale that we're talking about? The scale that we're talking about to leading order is that x is z plus z times some connection coefficients times some energy. So the scale by which locality appears to fail for distant events is proportional to the distance times the connection coefficients times the energy. The connection coefficients have dimensions of 1 over energy or 1 over mass because they're part of the geometry of momentum space. So these might have a scale of 1 over some quantum gravity scale. Therefore, the scale of these non-local effects grows proportional to the distance times the ratio of the energy flowing through the world line to some quantum gravity energy. I.e., we're used to looking for quantum gravity effects at very short distances, but these are quantum gravity effects at very long distances. Okay? And let me unfold a little more how those effects happen. Okay. Now, what everything I've been talking about has been general. I have just said that there is this geometry of momentum space. It can have a metric, it can have a connection, curvature, non-metricity, etc. If you want to specify the geometry further to study it, you can, and different things are under study, and they already have names. So there's something called the correspondence principle for this context, which basically says the special relativity should hold when you're looking at momentum space on distances in momentum space smaller than some mass scale, and that tells you that the geometric tensors should scale appropriately, like 1 over that mass scale for the torsion and non-metricity and 1 over that mass scale squared for the torsion. There's a notion of an equivalence principle that all the quanta, all the different degrees of freedom should find the same geometry of momentum space. And then you could decide to constrain the geometry of momentum space as much as possible to get a model with 1 degree of freedom. So you can require that momentum space has a maximal symmetry And then it's a copy of a de Sitter geometry or an anti-de Sitter geometry with the radius of curvature given by the quantum gravity scale. Okay? And these different ideas are under study. I'm not going to say more about them. What I'm going to do now is talk about one experiment, and then I'll be done, okay, which is the gamma ray burst experiment. Yeah, quick questions, because I have 15 minutes and an experiment to describe. Who knows? I have not thought about whether the topology could be non-trivial. No. It doesn't. It doesn't. Let me describe an experiment and it should be clear. Okay? So let me emphasize here, theorists are free to study whatever they want to, but our responsibility as theorists is to find experiments that measure these degrees of freedom. That is, we've introduced new degrees of freedom into physics, which we argue are inherited from whatever is the fundamental theory in this phenomenological description. And these degrees of freedom, the curvature of momentum space, are to be measured. And its theorists can study all we like, but what we really should be doing is finding experiments that measure or bound these degrees of freedom. And so I'm going to tell you about one of them, which is what the gamma ray burst experiments measure. Okay. So I mentioned this before, two photons are created simultaneously. Now we have to say according to who? According to a local observer at the gamma ray burst, but with very different energies. Do they arrive and are they detected at the Fermi satellite simultaneously? That's the experimental question. Here's a wrong argument, which I'm happy to say is a wrong argument because I, among other people, have endorsed it and published it, but now understand it to be a naive, wrong argument. You can choose coordinates on the curved momentum space so that when you compute the speed of a photon, by taking the derivative of the energy by the momentum in the energy-momentum relation, you get an energy-dependent speed. And then you just plug that into the formula, and you find a time delay which goes like a few, on the order of a few seconds when the scale is the Planck mass, the time of flight is 10 billion years, and we're talking about photons of a 10 GeV, which Fermi has detected. So you think that you're really cool. However, physics should be coordinate invariant. So it is also the case that you can choose coordinates on momentum space so the speed of light is a constant. An example of these are Riemann normal coordinates, which you can choose on momentum space, such that the distance function, there should be a square there, is just looks like in Minkowski space. That is, these are coordinates on a curved space that if you only are measuring the distance of a point from the origin, it just looks like a quadratic function. And in these coordinates, the derivatives of the metric at the origin are zero, so the connection coefficients have in them no derivatives of the metric, but only the torsion and the non-metricity. The torsion is in some anti-symmetric parts, and the non-metricity is in some symmetric parts. Okay? So, is there no time delay? Because you can choose coordinates where there is the speed of light is universal. So that suggests that the two photons, if they leave at the same time, should arrive at the same time. Well, to find out, you have to actually compute the proper time between the detection of the two photons. And this is a calculation that Laurent and I have done in the last few weeks. And here's what it looks like. We set it up. There's some atom in the whatever is the source of the gamma ray burst. It emits a photon of some event at an energy we're going to assume is almost zero. A proper time later, where that's the proper time of an observer sitting on that atom, it emits a second photon of a much higher energy, E2. They travel for times T1 in the frame of the first atom, and time T2, and they're detected by an atom in a detector assumed to be at rest with the original atom, with respect to the original atom, and there's some proper time between the two detections. and we neglect everything except the energy of the second photon. And we ask, is the proper time between their emissions the same as the proper time between their detections? And the answer is that it's not, even when we use coordinates where the speed of light is constant. And in fact, here's the result. The proper time difference between the two detections is proportional to the energy of the second photon, or it's really the energy difference, times the time traveled in the frame of reference of the detector, times some particular, these are null coordinates because the photons are on null trajectories, times some particular components of the connection coefficients, which in the coordinates where the speed of light is constant turns out to be just the non-metricity. So the leading order effect is due to this obscure property of geometry that the connection may not be compatible with the metric. The covariant derivative of the metric may not be constant. And that's the leading order effect. That leads to a leading order in energy and time delay. I.e., if you set the first proper time equals zero so the emission is simultaneous, the detection is not simultaneous. What the hell is going on? Well, what's going on depends on your frame of reference, because locality is relative. And we've done these calculations, and the following, I'm not going to show you the calculations, but the following is the result of the calculations. If you describe the process in the reference frame of the observer at the gamma ray burst, 10 billion light years away and ago, okay, then the two photons are emitted simultaneously. They travel on the same world line at the same speed, but they have different energies, and the interactions where they're absorbed by the atom in the detector are non-local, and the size of the non-locality is proportional to the energy of the photon. So the one of the really massive photon, really energetic photon, is more non-local than the one of the light photon, and the result is that the detectors click at different times. Because from the observer here, the distant interactions appear non-local in a way that's energy dependent. Well, that's weird. Let's describe it from the point of view of the detector of an observer sitting on the Fermi satellite here, who has to see the detection events being local. That observer sees the detection events as local, but they see the emission events as non-local, so the two photons are on different world lines that arrive at different times. So the descriptions are different because locality is relative, but the difference in the arrival times is an invariant, is a proper time, and all observers agree. Okay. So that's an application of relativity of locality. That is, it's coordinate dependent, but it's observable, and what's really going on here is that there's a closed loop that you can describe. Okay. Now, there are also higher order terms if you believe the non-metricity shouldn't be there. There are higher order terms which measure the curvature, which I'm not going to tell you about today. However, if you believe the measurements that were published from that Fermi event, from that 32 GeV photon, then you actually have a bound on some components of the non-metricity tensor. That is, you've bounded some property of the geometry of momentum space by something on the order of the Planck scale. Okay. So this is a real experiment measuring a real property of momentum space. Okay. And let me emphasize that what I've just told you is paradoxical if you insist, if you believe that both observers are making a description, reconstructing the description of this process in the same space-time, then you get a paradox. Because how could it be that this observer sees that event to be non-local and the event near them to be local and vice versa? It's paradoxical, and it's not difficult to turn that paradox into a contradiction if you assume that the space-time reconstructed by the different observers is the same space-time. But when you understand that what is invariant that the observers share is a phase space, and that you project out from the phase space where you have to know coordinates and momenta to a description just in a coordinate language, that projection is observer dependent, depends on the energy and depends on the origin, then you resolve the paradox. The paradox evaporates. Okay. I'm almost done. There are a few more things that I plan to say, so let me just tell you what they are in case anybody wants to ask in the question session, and I'll be done. You can also understand that the Einstein localization process is also energy dependent, and indeed that's underlying the experiment I just told you, so that the coordinates of distant events that you assign by bouncing off of light signals to and from it indeed depend on the energy at that event and the energy of the light signals. There's a problem called the soccer ball problem. The soccer ball problem is if there are nonlinear effects in the scattering of elementary particles which are proportional to the masses of those particles or their energies over the Planck mass, then what happens if I kick a soccer ball, which is made up of lots of little particles? Shouldn't I see nonlinear effects which are proportional to the energy of the soccer ball over the Planck mass? But that's a huge number, so isn't all of this obviously nonsense? Okay. And in this scheme, now that it's well defined, so that's the question, the answer is that the nonlinearities in the soccer ball scale like n times the Planck mass, where n is the number of particles in the soccer ball. So soccer balls appear to scatter linearly because their energy is much smaller than n, than the Avogadro's number times the Planck mass. And there's more to say about that. There are other experimental windows that we've been thinking about. One of them, to measure the curvature of momentum space, you want to make a circle in momentum space. And of course, if you're in a storage ring or an accelerator where you're putting particles around a circle in space, they're making a circle in momentum space. And there are novel effects analogous to Thomas precession, which one can compute, which go like energies squared over the Planck scale, squared. And these were first pointed out by Florian Girelli and Atero Levine in a different or related context. There's also a cute idea where, since the space-time associated with quanta that have different energies is different, the proper time is energy dependent. And consequently, one can do interferometry in phase space. One can take a photon of some frequency, put it through a doubler where the outcomes of photon of that frequency and twice that frequency, put the first one, let it propagate like that a long time, put the first one through a doubler again, then you have two components which have frequency twice the original one, one that has had the higher frequency for a long time t and one that hasn't. And there's a prediction, if there's curvature in the momentum space, that there's a phase shift that you could measure by interference proportional to the omega squared and the time. Okay, again, any of these things we can discuss more. There's some speculative remarks about the black hole information loss paradox I can mention if anybody wants. They're very hand-waving. And so here's my conclusions. Physics, of course, takes place in Hilbert space. Okay. So why, when we take the h-bar goes to zero limit, do we think of physics taking place in space-time? Because in Hilbert space, there's a reciprocity. You can use a momentum basis or a position basis. So why, when you take the limit h-bar goes to zero, don't you go to phase space rather than position space? And indeed, Max Born made this argument in about 1938, 1939, which is the first paper we know of that argued for a curved geometry of momentum space. Okay. Indeed, here's a limit. If you take the Newton's constant to zero while you take h-bar to zero, if your theory had gravity in it, your quantum theory had gravity in it, you can take a limit where the Planck mass remains. And then our point is you do generically go to phase space. You don't go to space-time. You go to a description where you need both position and momenta, and you can't just describe processes in position space-time. this scale MP can measure the geometry of space, of momentum space. If that momentum space is curved, there's no invariant notion of space-time. If you try to describe physics just in space-time, you end up with paradoxes. There is only an invariant phase space. So if the momentum space is curved in this regime, space-time is as misleading a concept as the notion of spaces in special relativity. Phenomenon where you can measure this mass scale appear paradoxical if one attempts to describe them using just space-time and not phase space. Okay. These apparent paradoxes, and this is what is coded into the presentation that I gave, appear to go away by working consistently in the phase space of the curved momentum space. As I touched on very briefly, the soccer ball problem goes away, and the ambiguities in the coordination of different events are not paradoxical. They lead instead to consistent predictions of phenomena like time delays. The geometry of momentum space is measurable and characterizes an interesting regime of quantum gravity effects, which are large-scale effects which grow proportional to the distance. They're not tiny Planck-scale effects. And let me emphasize, in the regime we're talking about, where h bar and g are zero, the Planck length is zero. So there's no quantum geometry effects, but there are effects that come from the fact that the Planck mass is not zero. Okay. And I've mentioned three possible experiments. There are others around the corner. And therefore, this is not fundamental physics. This is a phenomenological description, but it's a phenomenological description that could capture a set of possible quantum gravity effects. And there's a lot of to do. There's a lot coming. And around the corner, but not to be discussed yet, is what happens in this picture when we then turn again on H bar and G. So let me come back to the introduction, okay, to what I said at the introduction, which maybe sounded bald-faced and confident and whatever. Okay. All this could be wrong. The geometry of momentum space may be flat. That's now an experimental question. If it is, we relativists live in space-time. But if the geometry of momentum space is detected to be curved by experiments such as these, then what you see when you are looking out is phase space, and quite literally we mean what we say. The space-time description that you would see with the red filter and with the blue filter and with the gamma ray filter are all different. They're different by tiny amounts having to do with distances times energy scales over Planck scale, but nonetheless they're different. We don't live in space-time. If this is true, we live in phase space. So thank you very much.
So I'm going to use the microphones in view of the background noise. So please wait until you get the microphone before asking your question.
When you contrasted your calculation with the experiment at the Fermi satellite, in your calculation you assumed that the two photons were locally emitted within like 1 second or very close to each other, mm-hmm. and that we would infer like if you'd still see them separated by 1 second or if that time distance would increase. But by that, aren't you assuming that we know for how long a gamma burst ray goes, that it goes for 1 second? But
yeah,
by
yeah,
that,
so
like, we are already saying that we can trust the time that we see.
You're asking how do I get a bound like that?
Yes.
Yeah. We don't know. Here's the gamma ray burst. In its frame starts here. I don't know what I'm drawing. Okay, there start to be photons emitted, okay, of different energies. Here's, let me assume this is energy, this is time. Okay. Here is some highly energetic photon, which is emitted some delta T after. Okay. It then is detected some delta T prime after the first light photons are detected. Okay. if the delay time formula is delta t goes as t e over m quantum gravity, and then what do we know? We know, let me drop out, it's not really a question of relative locality. Whatever is the source of a decay like this, okay, we believe that the very energetic photon didn't start out before the burst started out. Okay. So we know the time delay was not longer than this measured time delay. Therefore, we know that this time delay is shorter than a delta t measured, and therefore we know that the quantum gravity scale must be greater than some m star which is measured. In other words, from knowing that the time delay was not longer, we get a lower bound for this scale. We get an upper bound for the magnitude of the effect and a lower bound for this scale. Does that make sense? Yeah. I should say, as a theorist, the experimentalists may find, you know, the most important lesson for we theorists to learn when confronting experiment is learning the difference between making a measurement and setting a bound. Okay. And it's much for one photon, and this is an experiment, this is a result which depends on one single photon which was detected. It's sufficient to get a bound. It's not sufficient. You can't make a measurement because you don't know when the photon was emitted, but you can get a bound.
So I actually did want to ask you about the black hole information paradox.
Okay.
And in particular, I've heard Lenny Susskind make some claims in that context, which sounded kind of vaguely similar about, you know, local events becoming non-local at high momenta, stuff like that. So, well, but you tell me what you think, and I was wondering
same. If you understand that this is hand-waving, here's the idea, okay? There's some quanta of interest. It falls inside the horizon at some time t equals zero. At a much, much longer time, you want to know can it be detected outside the horizon or not. At some large time t, there's an ambiguity, and this is classical. There's no h-bar in this formula. There's an ambiguity in where it would be coordinatized to be proportional to the time later times some power of its momentum over the Planck mass. And n equals 1 if it's a linear effect having to do with the connection coefficients, and n equals 2 if it's a curvature effect. Okay. If this photon or quanta is sitting inside the Schwarzschild radius, I promised you hand waving, so don't yell at me. Okay. Then it has a momentum greater than the uncertainty momentum given by it being inside the Schwarzschild radius. So this, and there is an h-bar that appears there. So this uncertainty in its coordinate position is now greater than this quantity here. At some time non-local later, that's, since this effect grows with the capital T, which is the time after the quanta went into the horizon, okay, this uncertainty in position is larger than the Schwarzschild radius, and that is this expression. The evaporation time is the same thing with a cube. The claim is if n equals 1 or 2, which are the two cases of interest, then the time where the uncertainty due to this new relative locality effect is larger than the horizon scale happens before or at the evaporation time. Therefore, by the time the black hole is evaporating, you don't know whether the quanta is inside or outside the black hole. Okay. With all apologies, this is so hand-waving, it's embarrassing, but that's the argument.
But this is supposed to be what an observer far outside the black hole would see.
This is as would be judged by an observer when the quanta is put into the black hole. If you run it backwards,
an
observer
that's falling with the particle, or that's staying outside?
Staying outside.
Yeah, okay.
If you want to run it backwards, you can say that an observer with a black hole when it's almost evaporated doesn't know whether this quanta fell in or not, because when the quanta fell in, its ambiguity in position is much larger than the Schwarzschild radius.
Okay. But an observer then that falls in with the
particle, we are not able to.
You can't say anything about that. Okay.
Yeah. This is very preliminary. I mean, this just says that there is a chance to address such an issue.
So, what is the resolution to the soccer ball problem?
Please.
What is the resolution to the soccer ball problem?
The resolution of the soccer ball problem? The resolution of the soccer ball problem is that if you have n particles incoming in the soccer ball, n particles in the kick, wherever the kick is, and n particles outgoing, and you assume that what happens in the kick, you assume that each of these particles has the same momentum and energy. I can talk about a distribution and it makes things complicated, it doesn't change the result. And you assume that what happens is that each particle, each atom in the soccer ball receives a momentum transfer, which is 1 over n of the total momentum transfer to the soccer ball. Okay. So the momentum transfer, the total momentum transfer is n times the elementary momentum transfer to each atom. And the total momentum of the soccer ball before and after is n times the momentum of each of the particles before and after. And you assume that the relationship for each particle is this, the conservation law is nonlinear with some connection coefficients gamma as the leading term. Okay. Then you just scale everybody by n, and to turn this into a formula for the big incoming and outgoing momentum and momentum transfer, the nonlinear term has to get scaled by 1 over n. Therefore, if gamma is the connection coefficient relevant for each atom, 1 over n times gamma is the connection coefficient which is relevant for the center of mass momenta. And therefore, if the connection coefficients are of order 1 over m Planck, for the elementary process, the connection coefficients for the soccer ball are 1 over n times m Planck.
So you're saying that gamma is not a universal function of the momentum of space. Different particles have different momentum of spaces with different gamma.
It is a necessary consequence of the nonlinearity of the conservation law that there is a distinction between the conservation law for elementary particles and the conservation law for composite systems. That's not an assumption. That's a consequence. Okay. But if you think it through clearly, There just never was a soccer ball problem. Okay. Then there's another bit of it which has to do with the energy-momentum relation. And the point is that since you can always choose coordinates, so the energy-momentum relation is quadratic, there's also no soccer ball problem in the energy-momentum relation because it's the same as special relativity. So those are the two parts to the resolution.
So I'll just ask my question a bit more precisely than I did earlier, which is...
Can you speak?
I'll just ask the question a little bit more precisely than I did earlier, which is this non-locality that you see, you say that it's dependent on the distance, but also on the energy. And that's a bit confusing to me, because I thought at some level you said that the non-locality that appears is dependent on the energy alone. So where does the distance, how far you are from the observer, why should that, where does that come into the...
Well, where it comes... So let me handle it by dimension. So that's a very, very good question. Why does the effect we're talking about, the apparent coordinate effect, why does it grow with distance? Okay. So let me first make a dimensional argument, and then I'll try to be more insightful, give more insight into the geometrical construction where it comes from. all of this is at h bar equal to zero. What we have available is a mass scale, the speed of light, and nothing else. Okay? We want to make a delta x. A delta x could be proportional to an energy over the Planck mass to some power. That's dimensionless. But if we want to get a delta x that's related to the energy, we have delta x equals energy over the Planck mass to some power times something which has to have dimensions of length, because there's no h bar, so there's no way to turn energy into length. So there has to be x itself. In other words, it has to be delta x over x is proportional to energy over Planck mass. That's, so if you're going to have an effect in the classical theory related to the Planck mass, which involves non-locality, it has to be of that form, just from dimensional considerations. Now, how it comes from the geometry is that is, and I'll try, I could go back to the pictures, but the key idea is here's a curved space, which is momentum space. Here's the position of a particle of momentum p. It lives in the tangent space over the momentum p. Here's the momentum, here's the world line of a different particle with a different momentum, k. It lives in the tangent space over k. Okay. If we're going to relate them, describe in an invariant way an interaction between them, we have to, in this higher dimensional space, which is the phase space, parallel transport this object. Because the momentum space is curved, the tangent space above different momenta are different spaces, and we have to parallel transport the vectors to each other or to a common place to relate them, to have them talk to each other in a physical interaction. Okay. And so there's a kind of lever arm. You're parallel transporting, and the bigger the vector you're parallel transporting, the bigger the effect of the nonlinearity in the parallel transport can be. Is that good enough? I mean, it's very surprising when you think about it, because it, I think it, this really took us a while to appreciate, for one thing, because the whole discussion really cleaned up when we got rid of H-bar. That is, originally when we were trying to understand these ambiguities and possible paradoxes in the papers of Sabina and Bill Unruh and Schultzfeld, we were troubled by the H-bars, and it was possible to invent all kind of misleading arguments. Without H-bar, it's very clean. And what you learn is really, my two-sentence version is that the reciprocity between position and momentum has a remnant at H-bar equal to zero if you can take a limit where Newton's constant goes to zero while H-bar goes to zero, giving you a mass scale. There's no Planck length scale. Quantum gravity effects have gone away, but there's still a mass scale. And effects having to do with that mass scale, for the reason I just gave, show up as kind of infrared effects. They show up at large distances, not at small distances, because the scale of small quantum gravity distances, square root of h bar g, has gone to zero. But h bar over g has not gone to zero. And that codes a different kind of quantum gravity effect, which are infrared kind of effects.
Coming back to the soccer ball issue.
Happily, we're still there.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that's true. So it looked like the answer, I mean, the explanation that you gave only depended on big P and big K, you know, the macro, whereas I thought the idea was that it was supposed to, the addition law was supposed to be, non-commutative and non-associative, so it depended on what order you added up the little P's and little K's. And where you put the parentheses to tell you which guys you added first or second.
Good. Okay. So you're raising the issue of when I say that, that the total momenta here is n times the little momenta of each atom, am I lying? Maybe what I really mean is P nonlinear plus P, nonlinear plus P, nonlinear plus P, an Avogadro's number of times.
Or P plus K plus P plus K, or something like that.
Well, this is the total momenta of the soccer ball. There's no K yet.
Right. I guess I'm talking about when you add them both together. I was going to ask, is this the average?
This equation,
average that you would get?
Will you agree, is a consequence of this equation? So it's just true. If I take this equation, I multiply by n, then I multiply the k by n, I multiply this equation by n. I get p total here, p total here, p total here, and whoops, I need another n because I got to multiply p and k both by n, so I got to have a 1 over n. It's just the simplest kind of arithmetic. It's just true. There is no soccer ball problem.
I mean, doesn't the answer depend on what order I put the p's and k's in the string of an Avogadro's number?
Oh, so now you're coming back here. So let me give you an answer at two levels of sophistication. I'll give you the more sophisticated answer before the less sophisticated answer.
Why
I understand the question you're asking. Okay. It's what I said here. Why don't I go p plus nonlinear p plus nonlinear p plus nonlinear p 10 to the 24 times?
Or in addition to that, why do I get to add up all the p's first and then all the and then add all the k's?
Yeah, or p plus k n times. Okay, so the sophisticated answer and then the unsophisticated answer. The sophisticated answer is that in the nice coordinates that we like, which are Riemann normal coordinates, p nonlinear p is the same thing as p ordinary plus p. So in the nice coordinates, which I turn to make a clean argument, it is also what you want it to be equal to. Okay. Then you could worry about what about fluctuations, and might fluctuations make a big thing, and I think we should have a private discussion about that. That's the sophisticated argument. Okay. The unsophisticated argument is, I'm free to make this definition. Shoot me. I'm free to say the total momenta is n times the little momenta. It satisfies a linear conservation law when n is large because I can neglect this term. So it corresponds to what people measure in undergraduate physics labs when they kick soccer balls. Okay?
Okay, we should finish there. Laurent is giving a talk next week on Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock on the same subject, so people that are interested can continue to pursue it. In the meantime, let's thank Lee once again.
Thank you very much.